This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. What a pleasure to be with Tony Horowitz, who has taken us at the leading edge to a variety of interesting places in your book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. In your book, Confederates in the Attic. In your not-so-new book, where you took us off to see where Captain Cook had been. And then, of course, all those years, including a Pulitzer Prize at the Wall Street Journal. One of the things that I found interesting is how I hadn't expected all those academics that you acknowledge at the back end. And yes, you did a tremendous amount of research and a tremendous amount of just that gut work that you got to do to figure out what the story is. I was surprised how many times the unexpected person took you to an unexpected place that was just a gold mine simply because you came in politely and asked around, and you really do like to go have that beer at the end of the day.
Sure.
But that simple humanity of being open to everyday people took you to just glorious places. Mm-hmm. And that alone almost felt like a lesson. Mm-hmm. If one were to be open, that there are worlds to discover.
I think it's the dirty secret of journalism or reporting, whatever we're going to call it today. It's not that hard. If you approach people, as you say, just with a certain amount of courtesy and curiosity, everybody will talk to you. In the 20-plus years I've been writing as a reporter or book writing, usually just wandering around, meeting people for the first time, the number of times people have refused to talk to me, I can count on one hand. And that includes, you know, terrorists and Saddam Hussein's son, who I ran into in a nightclub once in Baghdad, and I thought, what the heck? Went up and talked to him. I didn't really get anything interesting, but he talked to me. I think we make assumptions about other people that for whatever reason they won't talk to us.
Well, and there's a great line when you quote somebody, gosh, you're hard to get rid of. Come on, get in the boat.
Sometimes you have to exploit people's hospitality, I have to say.
And invite them to be inviting. That's not exploitation.
It's a little exploit. You know, people, particularly in the South, are very hospitable. They won't tell you to get lost. And if you hang around...
No, but they will not tell you anything.
Sometimes, but if you hang around and hang around, often as I did with the person you're describing, who is an Indian in Virginia, belongs to a tribe that has really been through a lot from white society, a little bit wary of strange whites rolling in and asking personal questions.
And As well they might be.
And I hung around and after a while kind of broke the ice. You know, sometimes you can perhaps push that too far, but I do find just showing up and showing up again and again, if you feel you've got potentially rich material, is worth the effort. It doesn't work every time, but in general, people will talk to you.
It was not Woody Allen, it was Napoleon that said that 90% is showing up.
Is that true?
He stole it.
Napoleon made his career by laying siege to a town, I think, in Spain that the French had been trying to deal with for some time, and he was an artillery officer, and he just stuck around and kept raining artillery on the town until they finally gave up. But it took a long, long time, and that's the source of it. But it also, what you're saying reminds me of Danny Colson, who was deputy director of the FBI, who said precisely the same thing about solving crimes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
If you talk to enough people,
and listen to enough people,
somebody will tell you who did it.
Oh, well, that's
But that's it is precisely the same thing as what you're describing. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a lesson that a lot of us forget. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people in the profession forget that the
profession of
journalism, news, whatever we're talking about. And I think it's particularly destructive, now that I'm on a tear, when what passes for news now largely is people like us sitting around and having opinions about things they have no direct contact with.
You got to get out and talk to people.
Exactly. Yeah. And what you said earlier, that our reporters, our media don't do that the way they used to. We don't have the bureaus around the world we don't have the people like you.
Well, no, I think there's still, look, I'm a great defender still of newspapers. I think there's a lot of great reporting out there. I think it's simply the resources aren't there to do it, as much of it as there used to be, the kind of in-depth stories, and they're competing with blogs and CNN and every, you know, 24-hour news, so that the whole mission has changed. So I don't think it's that there are people who aren't doing it or who don't want to do it. I just think the resources to do it are diminishing, and that's a real pity.
Well, here's a possibility for you. This may be, you tell me if it's an analogy or a metaphor. I can never remember which is which. I was with a young friend recently when I said I went to Washington. Right. We did a road trip, and she thought we were going to get on the highway, and that would be the superhighway, the interstate, and drive up there, and then I took the train back. Well, phooey on that. We went all back roads. Yeah. There were roadblocks, so we had to go a different way. We had to use the map. We're halfway into Virginia. I said, "Have you ever been on the Blue Mountain, the Blue Ridge Parkway?" And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "Ooh." Oh, so we go back through some small towns, and it was on a Monday, so there was no traffic. It was all to ourselves. It seems to me that an awful lot of journalism has gotten stuck on the interstates.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right,
ignoring what is so rudely called the flyover country, and one of the things that she said as we were in these mountains and we were in the Smokies and we were on the Blue Ridge, she's never seen the big mountains, so this was she was just head shaking and how did people do this? Well, as you did your own journeys, the arduousness of all of this is impossible to imagine if you don't have Tony going through doing it on superhighways and in an air-conditioned car and beer at the end of the road and stuff. The accomplishment, for all that I do not admire what they did, is awesome.
Right.
And it's as if we've gotten stuck on the superhighways and have forgotten all of the richness that is there to be had.
Right. Well, it relates to the people I'm writing about. Yeah, I don't think we have to admire these people in any way to still recognize that what they did is significant and awe-inspiring.
I mean, and it happened.
DeSoto, who to my mind is probably the greatest monster in the book, is also just incredible. He leads this 3,000-mile death march across the South, and as one military person I interviewed in the book said, you know, Navy SEALs today would be dropping dead, you know, after a day of what he was doing for 3 years.
And that guy was holding up the Navy SEALs as the ultimate.
Exactly. Navy SEALs are tough dudes, and he was saying they couldn't have hacked this. So I think, you know, it is striking to read the accounts and then get out in the landscape, be out in the Sonoran Desert when it's, you know, 120 degrees, to get a little sense of, or swamps of Florida, what these people put up with. And, yeah, as you say, to get away from the quite cushy interstate travel that we do. But I think also, back to sort of interstates, I think there's, and this is not about journalism, really, it's about all of us and how we think about travel. I think there's this notion abroad that every place looks the same and that there's almost no point in traveling anymore because you know, it's all one big Starbucks, and you know, and obviously, if you only go on the interstates and to Atlanta Airport, it does all look the same.
Strip mall heaven.
But you know, as you were just describing, you don't have to get very far off the interstate to find that there are still tremendous regional differences, tremendous local differences. There's a whole nother world. You know, an hour's drive from almost any major city, and it's not that hard again to get out there and discover it.
So if you know to do it.
Well, again, it doesn't take much. You know, you just got to, as you say, get off on those small roads and then, God forbid, stop and talk to a few people.
I've been told by people who are supposed to know these things that in America's national parks, something like 99% of people, 90%, never get more than 300 yards from the parking.
Yeah. From their car.
Yeah.
And the fact
is, I'm surprised they get that far.
Well, I think he was being generous. And if you go that extra 100 yards, you're in different space.
Wilderness.
You're actually in the national park and not in the national parking lot.
Good point.
And at the end of that trip, I ended up in Washington, D.C., which was our destination. And this is sort of ending that metaphor. We're going to put a little bow tie on this. And I wanted to walk between the Lincoln Monument and the Capitol. I really believe in democracy. I like Lincoln at one end and the people's representative, even if they don't do it very well, at the other. And I stood there, I said, this is a mall. Let us think of this as America's mall, not the strip malls and the shopping and stuff. And there was also that sense in this book, in A Voyage Long and Strange, to be looking at what it takes to grow from a time that is deeply magical thinking, which sometimes I think is this time, but the propensity for magical thinking among your exploring guys, whether you're talking about the Vikings 500 years before the 500 years ago, or you're talking about the Spanish and then the French and then the English who are coming with various agendi, metamorphosis of how the world looks, what it is that gets us to a time when we really could be a self-governing people if we choose to be. That sweep of history must have been thrilling for you.
Right. Well, particularly in terms of the landscape, and what's very painful to me as someone who's a history nut, and also, you know, I love my national parks and just nature generally, is just how much of it we've paved over. And, you know, but that being said, you know, an hour from Atlanta, you can go to Etowah, which I talk about in the book, that again, maybe people here in Georgia are aware of it, but I don't think many Americans know there was this fabulous mound culture here when Europeans arrived. This was not a virgin wilderness. This was a heavily populated, very sophisticated native culture here. And, you know, those places do still poke through, but it's next to a trailer park, and it's you have to drive past the Glad Wrap factory to get there. And we've kind of done our best to change that landscape that these early explorers were describing that's so wondrous. Part of what it's about is really just the wonder of America. Or, you know, and what it helped me rediscover was sort of, yes, this is an amazing country physically, you know, those huge rivers and mountains and forests, and these guys are really describing that in a way that can, you know, be hard to remember in this day and age as you're driving through those strip malls.
Part of this, you talk about it, is the myth-making that goes on. We have a colleague, Richard Slotkin, who's written about the American myth, read everything, even Fenimore Cooper, some of the really unreadables, to me, unreadables. Who argues, and a lot of people disagree with him, but argues that the American myth, as we have thought of it, has died sometime mid-Vietnam War, and that we're in need of a new myth. And in some ways, you've been sort of doing, you've been reconnoitering the territory from a historical standpoint, but also from a modern standpoint, because you've also, as a reporter, dealt very much with the here and now. One of the things he says any candidate myth, and he doesn't put one forward, that for a new American myth has to somehow or other deal with violence. Who gets to use it, under what circumstances, against whom, and of course race. Having said that, do you have a sense of anything emerging from your wide exposure and your thinking about it and sort of muddling through? Do you see
violence?
Wait a minute, guys. You can think about that, Tony. I'm going to give you a break.
Okay.
We'll be back in just a moment. Give him a chance to take a deep breath and say, oh, my goodness. Tony Horowitz will be with us when we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I, Paula, will be with us when we return.